Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The University of Tulsa School of Art opened its biennial juried contemporary ceramics competition and show yesterday. Red Heat, Contemporary Works in Clay, is on display at the Alexander Hogue Gallery through October 25th and showcases around 45 works by ceramic artists from across the country. This year's juror is my guest today and a former winner of that competition in 2007. Virginia Scotchy is a ceramic artist and the head of ceramics at South Carolina University. She's shown her work extensively throughout the U.S. and in France, Australia, Taiwan, and China. She's had public art commissions in Taiwan for the Yingyi Ceramic Museum and the Corporate Trinity Building in Charlotte, North Carolina. Scotchy has also been an artist in residence in Taiwan, Italy, Australia, and the Netherlands. An exhibition of her own work will open this evening at the Henry Zero Center for Arts and Education in the Brady District. Virginia Scotchy joins me today to talk about her work and the work of many other artists featured in Red Heat. Virginia Scotchy, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You're the jurist for Red Heat, and there's also an exhibit of your own work at the New Zero Center downtown. And when I look at your work, two things that strike my eye. One, you're working in what I'd say are functional forms, but in a non-functional manner. These are objects that have spouts. They have sort of bulbs like your vessel, but you're using them in very different ways. And the second thing is texture. That seems to be paramount in your mind. Are those some of the most important things as far as you consider your, when you consider your own art?
Yeah, those are definitely things I think about. My background in ceramics, my training was actually as a functional potter.
Mm-hmm. So you're a wheel turner, right?
I turn. In fact, a lot of the forms in the exhibition at Zaro are thrown on the wheel, then altered and assembled. Mm-hmm. And I just consider the wheel just to be another tool that I have at my disposal. You know, because I know how to use it.
Right.
But I do a lot of hand building also. Some of the pieces in the show are built by slabs, which is just taking flat pieces of clay and assembling them, and then also press molding, so making plaster molds and then filling it with clay. And it's just a vocabulary of, you know, technical skills to build up. But as far as the ideas behind the objects, I think that idea of function and non-function come into play. So you can look at some of the forms and think, it looks like I could pour something out of that, but because there's a hole in the center of it, it probably wouldn't come out of the spout. So, and there's also a relationship to the organic, you know, because I think a lot of the tools and things that we use as humans, you know, they began with organic things like picking up a stick or picking up a shell and using that in some way. So a lot of the tools I think that we use, you know, evolved from those very primitive tools that humans used. So I relate my work to that also.
There's sort of a primitive nature to some of these pieces, mm-hmm. too, just how they look. It looks like before we had modern kilns, it was, you know, an attempt to make a vessel. I know I don't want to say it looks simplistic because I'm sure it isn't.
Well, I mean, I love simplicity. And I mean, I consider myself a formalist in how I look at objects. I'm very interested in looking at objects that I don't know really what they're used for. So that kind of just seeing form and the simplicity of form without knowing the function is also important as to how I determine the pieces that I make.
And, of course, texture is the other big part of it.
Color which is, and texture.
Yeah, color. The colors are vivid. They're very bright. They're brighter than we usually think of in ceramics a lot of times.
You know, it's funny. Every color is in nature.
Sure.
You know, and I actually, as a professor, I've been in critiques with grad students, and a colleague of mine will say, you know, if a student is making organic work, well, that color, you know, isn't in nature. And I just kind of go, every color is in nature, you know, every color we can come up with, whether it's on land or in the sea. So I've kind of reflected upon that in my work, and especially with the textured glazes. You know, I might be thinking about a coral surface like you would see in the ocean, or with the green, kind of a very dense moss. And I'm juxtaposing that with the bronze glaze, that's a very much more human-made kind of surface, more mechanical than the texture glaze, which is much more organic.
Yeah, and that's a big part of this show is there's these connections between these objects that one half will be this bronze glaze, which almost looks like metal. And in fact, the first couple pieces where they were sort of like pedestals or top pieces, I thought, now is that really metal? And wanted to touch it, but knew better than to do that.
Everybody wants to touch ceramics.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And but this bronze glaze makes it look like it's actual bronze. And then you know, the other half of the object, or the perhaps the part of the object in the middle, has this, I call it a grackle glaze, yeah, which is, mm-hmm, you know, this sort of distressed, very tactile looking, mm-hmm, surface.
Yeah, I use that, the color, the texture glaze, and the bronze glaze to kind of dissect the form, you know, mm-hmm, and so you look at it in that way. The color leads your eye to the bronze area. And the glaze really does look like bronze, and it's a glaze that I've kind of reformulated, because glaze surfaces and textures is a big part of the research that ceramic artists.
And that's sort of one of your specialties too.
Yeah,
you're big into glazes and various.
But
textural.
I've simplified really for my own glazes, for my own creative work. So the textured glaze is just one basic recipe, and then I just use different oxides and stains to get the color. But they're multiple fired. You really can't build a surface up like that and put it in the kiln one time.
Are you talking about the bronze size or the grackle?
The textured size.
Yeah,
I'm
going to call it grackle. Because
grackle.
Because it looks like, you know, yeah, it looks like that sort of distressed thing you, mm-hmm, do to wood.
Yeah, there is a relationship there. So
is it somewhat the same process where you're doing multiple layers?
I kind of put it on like a stucco-like way, mm-hmm, with just a brush, just kind of dabbing it on. It's, mm-hmm, not dipped or poured like typical glazes. You know, but I'm very interested in how that, the way that glaze can make or unmake the form and change it, as opposed to the bronze glaze, which is just a smooth, you know, kind of, you know, mechanical
looking cool
surface.
Yeah,
yeah,
cool.
Yeah, yeah, it's a cooler, yeah. So that really, you know, the form, and then I make those decisions after I've built the piece. Those decisions are made before they go into the kiln, because wherever I apply the textured glaze, I have to texture the surface of the clay. Otherwise, it would just fall off. Mm-hmm. So I really kind of dissect the form and make those decisions before they go into the kiln. By the way, I have to texture the clay or leave an area smooth for the metallic glaze.
Now, what also strikes me is, you know, knowing that ceramics is it's almost a game of chance,
mm-hmm,
what comes out after the firing. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting is how precise, you know, the separations are between the smooth and the texture. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have some of the larger pieces have these large sort of vessel shapes, and half is absolutely smooth, and then just right down the middle, there's this very textural.
I always say I've never
tactile.
Draw a straight line, but maybe I'm getting better at it. I know sometimes when people say, I could never be an artist, I cannot draw a straight line. I'm like, well, that's not necessary. But I do want the work to be very well crafted. I mean, craft, you know, in some areas of art has become a, you know, negative connotation. But to me, craftsmanship in any form of art making, whether your intention in the craftsmanship is for it to be very loose, you know, it needs to be loose for intention, not just accidentally. So the craftsmanship of my work is very crucial to me. So, mm-hmm, I do spend a lot of time with that. And
now, you mentioned you started out as a functional potter.
Mm-hmm.
So that meant, you know, making plates, making bowls,
teapots, yeah,
all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Now, how does that affect, you know, now that you're probably less functional and more artistic, mm-hmm, in most of your work or all your work, how does that background figure in the artistic side of what you're doing?
Well, I think one thing I think about with my sculptures is always relate them to the idea of being a verb. There's always something about an action, whether it's pouring or putting your hand over a knob, much like you would do a doorknob to open a door. So I like to think about that as an artist. And I think any functional work is for use. So there's always the handling of it, the baking it or the mixing of it in a bowl. You know, so those ideas are still part of what I hold on to in my sculptures, although it's not as literal as a functional teapot or a functional bowl. I think that those ideas, you know, I still draw from that part of my past. You know,
and then in this show, we'll see work that is obviously meant to hang on the wall, but there's a spout out of the front.
Well, I do have two sons. So, anyhow, I think that you know, those are kind of playful pieces.
Yeah, they
and
are.
I just,
yeah,
took some of the elements, like the spout and the knobs, off of the objects and just really explored the possibilities of those just working alone as a sculpture.
And that's what I saw about, mm-hmm, this exhibit. It's like you have this big piece called Around the World,
mm-hmm,
and every element of that big piece of, I guess there are about 12
yeah,
pieces, and sort of almost set like a clock,
yeah,
in many ways.
It is, yeah.
And every element of those are reflected in other pieces, and I assume that's part of the whole?
It is. You know, the circular form on the wall really came about when I was teaching for a semester at University of Hawaii, and we were getting ready to set up the show in the gallery, and it was empty, and there's this big, huge white wall, and there was one spotlight hitting that wall that made a circle. And before that, most of my objects were set up in grids or diamond shapes, you know, much more linear in shape. And when I saw that circle of light on the wall, I just said, I want to do a big circle. And it's much more difficult to set up a circle of 12 objects. But around the world, not just relates to the idea of it being circular, but I think a lot of my inspiration of just very simple objects, architecture, clothing even, is inspired by my trips to different locations.
So does each one of those pieces or some of those pieces represent different cultures in a way?
There's actually a form I call a pagoda form, which came from my travels in China, where I saw so many beautiful ancient pagodas.
You know, the one on top is, it looked like a crown to me.
Yeah. Everyone needs a crown. So I believe that. So, you know, the crown shape is just something that I use that I saw in probably some culture where there was that kind of shape that someone was wearing on their head. It's not like so many different kinds of crowns that you can think of. So it's not a typical British crown or anything like that, but it's almost like a kid's crown in a way. And I like my work to have like a playfulness or a childlike quality to it, you know, because there's just no question about it. I mean, working in clay is fun. It's just so tactile, and it, you know, you really don't even need to use anything dangerous to work in clay. Your hands are really all you need. So it's that immediacy that I want to have reflected in my work.
It's interesting you mentioned, you know, this childlike quality, because some of the objects, my first connection was like of contemporary animation, which, you know, contemporary, a lot of contemporary animation has become, you know, incredibly detailed. And then there's this other school where it's gone back to, you know, like this blob-like shape. Yeah. And, you know, put eyes and a mouth on it, and that's, and, you know, and it walks and talks. And in some cases, it's like some of that throwback sort of geometric forms of animation. And it's interesting to me that in this day and age that's interesting to kids.
Right.
And some of the same forms are reflected.
I was a member of the Mickey Mouse Club. So.
But this is very different
forms,
animation.
I know, but one of my forms really came from looking at that.
Really?
Of the Mickey Mouse. It's a balloon that my son got when we went to Disney World. It was a blow-up balloon. It was just no face or anything on it, but just the shape of Mickey Mouse and his ears.
It's the sort of iconic ears and
iconic
face.
Yeah. And so I do think there's a relationship to the kind of manga, comic book, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. And I see those connections, but I think we are artists. You know, when you're an artist, you're working in the world around you. You know, so even if you try to isolate yourself, you cannot separate yourself from your culture. Whether it be just something that's in the grocery store, something that's on TV, you know, something that's at Target, you know, whatever it is, you know, you're going to somehow visually incorporate those things in your work.
I want to ask you, just as an artist who's working with 20, 21, 22, 24, 25-year-olds on a regular basis, how does that affect your work, your own work, when you see some of the things your students are doing? And, you know, they, you know, maybe have a naive innocence about some of the things they're doing, but sometimes that works out really great. I mean, does that sort of keep your own work young in a way?
Well, you know, it's interesting because the crucible project or the crucible form that I've made in some of my work actually came from looking at some of the very beginning cylinders that students would make the very first time they threw on the wheel. And some of those forms, it's just like a cylinder, like a cup shape. Mm-hmm. The project is to give them 1 pound of clay, and from that they have to throw a 6-inch cylinder. You know, so the inside and the outside are all taken into consideration. And I just loved the simplicity of that form. And so I went and worked in my studio at home, and mine are very large and they're hand-built, but I wanted to kind of capture that kind of awkwardness.
Now, when I think of the crucible, I'm going to show my own ignorance here, but I think of it as a form or model that you use in metalsmithing or something like that, you know, like a cup form that you use to fill in. So is that what we're talking about when you talk about a crucible, just a model that...
Well, a crucible is used in bronze casting for pouring the liquid bronze.
Right.
You know, and so it has that kind of relationship. So crucible also talks about fire and alchemy and... you know, the action of making something that's hard, molten,
So tell us a little about this Crucible project. This is something you're actually working with about four or five
artists.
Are they all ceramic? Ceramic artists?
Ceramics, glass, some mixed media.
Okay, but basically you're incorporating fire.
Yeah, we are incorporating
fire. So a sculptor, like a bronze, somebody working in bronze or something like that?
We have actually gotten together and worked in four different locations. And we'll just meet, you know, at one of the other artist studios and work for a period of a week. And it's nonstop energy. And it's wonderful collaboration. We don't go there with a set plan. But as we have been meeting, you know, three or four times, we start to pull together the pieces we already have and look at them and start talking about how we see them grouping together in relationships. So a lot of the energy for this just comes through working in the studio together. There's not a lot of planning ahead of time. And, you know, when you're an artist, a lot of times you're working alone in your studio, which is great, you know. But on the other hand, it's wonderful to work with artists who you admire, who you respect, whose work is different from yours, but you share certain common denominators in your feelings and thoughts about art, and just to get together and just work away for a solid week.
And I assume there's no preconceived notions. It's you just get into a common space pretty much.
We all work together in the same
and
space.
And throwing around ideas.
Yep.
And ideas. Somebody goes to the glass kiln, you go to the ceramic kiln. Somebody goes, you know, makes a maquette for a sculpture, that sort of thing.
And we'll pass pieces around also.
Really?
Yeah, we'll actually share.
Is there a set of prompts that you guys are using to begin, or is it just sort of... Here's something I'm thinking about, and that's a starting point.
Okay.
Is it like that?
Not so much, except some of us come to the table with forms we've made.
Okay.
Which makes us, you know, have a connection.
That gives you a starting point.
Yeah, one of the artists works a lot with a ladle form, you know, like a ladle that you would use for pouring something. And so I would throw or hand build small crucibles, which are just like cylinders, basically. Some of them have like a little spout, and then he would make these ladles. And we just pair them up. Another form I'm kind of known for is a sphere. Mm-hmm. I've done lots of large spheres.
And there's a large sphere in the show, yeah.
Is there?
I think there is. There's medium size, you know, it's maybe about like this.
Well, I've done big installations outside a lot.
So you're talking about
like 30
huge.
Yeah, 30 by 30 by 30 spheres out of clay going down to different sizes. But, you know, so in some of the collaborations, I've done spheres. And also I'm kind of known for putting holes in things. And the whole thing really started for me was about taking something and denying its function. And yes, I know colanders have holes and they function, but in typical things, you know, a hole just kind of takes away that sense of function. And also to go from the from the outside to the inside of a form, because every three-dimensional object has an interior. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to have the viewer come, and people are very attracted to looking into holes. You know? It's almost like voyeuristic to look inside of a small hole, and just it draws you towards a piece. So
getting back to the Crucible, though, you guys have been meeting together, and now you're about ready to start showing the work, right?
We have a few venues set up. One's at the National Conference for Ceramics in Houston in March, and then another one's going to be at the Montgomery Museum of Art next year. I'm not sure of the exact month, and then also at the Columbia Museum of Art. So we will get together, depending on the size of the space, how many pieces that we've collaborated on that we'll put together.
That sounds like a lot of fun.
It has been really great.
Yeah. My guest today is Virginia Scacci. She's a ceramic artist, head of ceramics at the University of South Carolina. She's also the jurist for the biennial Red Heat ceramic show that's on display at the Alexander Hogue Gallery. And an exhibit of her own work is on display starting today at the Zero Center in the Brady District. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. I want to ask about one other piece before we talk a little bit about Red Heat. And this is a really cool piece. It's called Seven Deadly Sins, and it's seven shopping carts filled with ceramic objects. Sometimes it's a pig, which I'm guessing is gluttony. I think there's a deer in another one.
Uh-huh.
Talk about this project.
Well, I come from a large Italian Catholic family. I'm the oldest of six children. And I went to Catholic school as a young girl. And, you know, religion has been a big part of like shaping my mind, you know, thinking about right and wrong and society. Actually, in college as an undergrad at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, I majored in sociology and religion because I felt the two were so closely tied in, like societies are built on religion. So as time has gone on and I've just thought about life and seeing some of the things happening in our society, political and social, I just wanted to make this piece called The Seven Deadly Sins, because that's something you learn, like the 12 commandments and all of that. You know,
it's been out there for artists for a long time.
Yeah, it has been. But, you know, I wanted to kind of tweak it a little bit to my own ideas. So the shopping cart was used because, as many people have seen, you see lots of homeless people, lots of shopping carts sitting on the side of the road, you know, them being pushed by people gathering cans. And it just became this thing that, you know, was made for the store to buy. You know,
it's a symbol of consumption, and it also it's a symbol of last resort.
Last resort.
Yeah. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Everything they own is in a shopping cart.
Right.
So that, to me, is sinful, that this is what's happening, you know, to society. And all the shopping carts were found. So they were found on the side of the road. I did go to a grocery store once and ask them if I could have a shopping cart, and they started laughing. They said, most of the time, people are calling us to come pick up the shopping cart in front of their house. So, but they did give me one because I needed a certain size. So inside each of these shopping carts, and it's something that I see continuing with, but one of them is filled with 47 punching bags. It was a punching bag that I made a plaster mold of, and they're all spray painted silver. And it's called Punch, mm-hmm. you know, because I think it's about anger and just aggression in our society, you know, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I actually have one of my siblings was 47 and he was murdered by an employee of his business. And that just changed my life in so many ways. And I never knew how to express that in my art until I made this piece.
So those were cathartic in many,
yes,
many ways.
Yes, it really was for me. Yeah. The 47 punching bags just kind of represent his age. And then the pig, of course, is gluttony, like you said. It's a big, huge pink with glitter, ceramic pig. And then I have two rabbits, which are about overpopulation. You know, I really think
lust?
We are. Or lust, yes. Each of them could be whatever you interpret. But they really, you know, I think that we have to be really careful.
What were you
with our
thinking
planet.
About?
Yes, I was thinking overpopulation.
Okay, all right.
And then I have...
I want to know how that lovely little deer...
The deer is really about us being like deer looking into headlights in action. The inaction of individuals, including myself, you know, when we see things that need to be changed.
I'm glad so it has like, nothing, some strange sin attached to
it's
it.
It's not about deer hunting.
Yeah.
But it's like this beautiful little deer and it's just looking ahead. It's like us being just frozen in action, you know, not trying to change the things that are happening that we see as being sinful.
It's a really cool piece.
Thank you very much.
Let's talk a little about Red Heat.
Okay.
Being a jurist, when you come in, what are you looking for? What are you looking for?
Well, first of all, the exhibition, and I've juried other exhibitions in the past, you know, I basically get a CD of the images sent to my home in Columbia, South Carolina, and I spend time looking at those images. So I don't actually get to see the pieces in real life. They're actually sent to me.
I think that would be tough.
It's very hard because
I would think, and especially in ceramics, you got to be able to see it. You want to pick it up and look at it.
That's why the quality of the images for all artists, particularly three-dimensional artists, are so important because that's all you get to see. So if the image is weak, if the photography is weak, it's going to make a strong piece look weak because all you have is the image to go by. And so knowing that, you know, I'm very careful to look at them, make reference to the sizes, because I'll have a sheet of paper that will tell you the sizes, the material, if it's porcelain or stoneware, you know, the glaze, all of that. I don't have the name. I don't have where the person's from. None of that. It's really just about the size, because you don't know if you're looking at an image, whether it's 2 inches tall or 2 feet tall. You know, you don't have a sense of that. So sometimes even when you read the size, you're a little surprised when you see it in person, like I did today for the first time, was to see the show and to give out the awards. So the awards are not given until the juror actually comes to the site and sees the work in the flesh.
Oh, so you don't actually say, okay, this is number one. I think it's going to be number one, but then you look at it, right, before you say,
really
this is number one.
Yeah. I mean, so basically it's a process of going through them, and I try to go through them all with a very open mind, going through them again, you know, kind of weeding out some of them, going through them again, you know, and I really, you know, want to think about, take into consideration the size of the space, you know, and then also, you know, where the work's going to be shown. And so kind of thinking about how many pieces should be in the show. And the university actually talked to me about this, the Department of Art, saying, you know, usually we get between 40 and 50 pieces, you know, depending on scale for the Red Heat show, which is a fabulous show. It happens once every 2 years, and I am really honored to be the juror for it this year.
Were there any surprises from seeing the imagery on you know, two-dimensional and all of a sudden seeing the real pieces where you said...
Actually, there were.
Uh-huh.
Definitely.
In what sense?
Well, some of the pieces are hanging. So they're hanging from the ceiling. And even though you see that in a, you know, an image, a digital image, until you can walk around it or see the shadows that it casts against the wall with the lighting in the gallery, you really don't, you know, get that in the image. So that was very surprising for me. And even though I knew the scale of some of the pieces, I was... You know, when you're standing in front of it, you go, oh, it really is that big, you know, or it's really that small.
Yeah.
There's two very small hands in the exhibition by an artist, you know, and I knew they were small when I read the size, but to see them in person, it was just and very well crafted.
And the detail is probably,
yeah,
is right there.
The detail also is really very interesting. So, you know, I think three-dimensional work, probably in many ways much more than two-dimensional work to see it in person, to touch it, you know, to sneak a touch, is, you know, for the juror to make this decision.
Now, for a juror, is that allowed? I would assume it would be.
Touch it.
I think that's it kind of goes with it, you know, because as you mentioned, everybody likes to touch ceramics.
Oh, yeah, it's true. It's very a tactile material. I mean, you don't necessarily want to go up and touch a sharp piece of steel, you know, or metal. You may want to touch a very smooth wood piece if you see that. But, I mean, it's just natural instinct to want to touch it. And it's unfortunate that, you know, we don't always get to do that. But
yeah, I'm always drawn to, like, bronze with lots of detail. You know, like a bronze that has all this sort of minute detail and they've you know, it's a really good casting. You just want to you just want
to
say, okay.
To understand it.
Yeah.
I mean, we understand through all of our senses. It's not just our eyes. I mean, you really use all of your senses. So you have that, you know, your mind is thinking, what would it feel like to touch that? And you're like, oh, what the heck? I'm just going to go ahead and touch it. You know.
Only jurists. Yes. Only jurists can do that.
Yes, because, you know, a lot of ceramic pieces have interesting things when you look at the bottom. You know, it goes back to the history of, like, Japanese tea bowls. The bottoms of the tea bowl were just as significant as the lip or the top of the tea bowl. In fact, the boxes that they were crated in to ship were just as important. And we, you know, when they were shipped to this country, the boxes went away.
Right.
And on the boxes, they were handmade, handmade ribbons tying them, poetry written on them. The name of the tea bowl was on the box. So a lot of that was just, you know, it was not in our culture to understand that.
Yeah, no. That is,
anyways.
Well, Red Heat will be up for several weeks and some great ceramic artists from around the region. I mean, this thing has really grown
all over the country now.
Yeah,
it's a very, very well-known and respected show in the world of ceramic art.
So that's at the Alexander Ho Gallery, and then Virginia Scacci's own work is on display at the Zero Center in the Brady District. Virginia, thanks very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
Ceramic artist Virginia Scacci speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. She's head of ceramics at the University of South Carolina and the juror for this year's University of Tulsa School of Art Red Heat Contemporary Works in Clay Biennial Ceramic Show, which is on display at the Alexander Ho Gallery through October 25th. There's also a display of Scacci's own work on display at the Zero Center in the Brady District. That opens this evening. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS and its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.